Welcome to the podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. Our podcast weaves together the message and a taste of the music that we experience each Sunday morning as we root our lives in grace through worship here at The Table. More and more people are finding their way to The Table through this podcast, so if you are one of the many, many folks who tune in each week from other parts of California, other parts of our country, or even from other places in the world, we would invite you to take a next step in growing in faith here at The Table. You can do that online at our website, thetableumc.org. There you'll find links to social media and also a way to make a deep commitment to our community to express how you hope to root your life in grace, to grow in faith, to reach in love, and to give generously. If you're one of the many people listening to this but haven't quite walked through the door of the sanctuary yet on a Sunday morning, we would love to welcome you into the beauty of this sanctuary. We gather each Sunday for worship at 9:30 and at 11. Our address is 5265 H Street in East Sacramento.
When it was evening on that day, the first day of the week, and the doors of the house where the disciples had met were locked for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After he said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples rejoiced when they saw the Lord. Jesus said to them again, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, so I send you." When he had said this, he breathed on them and said to them, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven them. And if you retain the sins of any, they are retained." But Thomas, who was called the twin, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the mark of the nails in his hand and put my finger in the mark of the nails and my hand in his side, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were again in the house, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were shut, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Do not doubt, but believe." Thomas answered them, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe." Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may come to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that through believing, you may have life in his name.
So I'm going to just jump right in because I'm excited. And I want to say also that with the wealth of everything you can find on the internet, we could not find a picture that was big enough to show you of this. So we're going to rely on memory. I'm 55, so okay. Some of you are way too young, probably. But raise your hand if you remember the green container that held grated Parmesan cheese. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Right. Really? You remember? Well, it's still out there, but it doesn't look the same, and the plastic's different. It's not the same color green cylinder. I looked. I tried to get you a picture. I want to say about that cheese that I liked it. It was all I knew. But in retrospect, what I can say is it tastes like salty dust, right? But it was all I ever knew. What I've learned is Parmigiano Reggiano is actually, I'm not going to try and say many of these words. I'm not even going to try. Is actually a region in Italy, and that is what that cheese actually looks like. Paul Geyer's going, "Yeah, Linda, I know." One of those weighs like 88 pounds. So it's more actually like a tire. That's how heavy it is. In 2012, that area suffered, Parmigiano-Reggiano, where it's made, suffered a huge number of earthquakes over a few days. And what happened when those earthquakes came that was terrible was that the homes were leveled, the churches were leveled, but maybe more importantly to them, the warehouses where the world's supply of over literally 400,000 wheels of Parmigiano came crashing down. Like, crashing down. And they are where all of our Parmesan cheese ages for the whole world. So it was a disaster on many levels. Those cheeses lay in disarray. And if they didn't get used in a very short period of time, they would be lost, which meant jobs would be lost in all of those villages around there, which meant the warehouses, the people who were raising their children on the farms, millions and millions of dollars represented in the livelihood of this cheese and those people who are very hardworking people. Enter renowned chef Massimo Bottura. Oh, someday I hope to meet him. He's like up there with George Clooney for me now. He had this amazing idea, right? Buy the cheese and save the whole land, the people, their jobs, the income, the economy. So here's what he did. He had them vacuum pack 2 1/4 pound wedges of that cheese. And then he had them sell it at discounted prices in temporary distribution centers through friends, through relations, through social media. So that's what started happening first. Then he named a date. Then Massimo created a recipe, a very distinct recipe just that he created that used Parmigiano Reggiano cheese. Then they asked the whole country of Italy on a certain day to create that recipe, right? But it didn't end up stopping there. And if you've watched the show, you know, it went worldwide. People in Japan did this. People in Germany did this. People in America did this. People in New Zealand did this. And in this way, the cheese got purchased, not wasted. The people survived the catastrophe. It totally worked. It completely worked. And he said this, a recipe is not just the sum of its ingredients. It is layered with meaning, people, places, and time. This recipe I created was a direct response to the earthquakes. And then he said, may it remain a call to unite, rejoice. I mean, who uses that word rejoice? Oh my goodness. Rejoice and remember that a recipe can also be an act of solidarity and social justice. A recipe, just a recipe. Well, this could really only happen back in 2012 because of the way in which Massimo Bottura had won the hearts and the palates of his beloved Italy over many, many years. It wasn't something that he was able to achieve at all overnight. So let me step back a little bit. Massimo is an Italian chef who grew up, literally, he says, under the kitchen table of his grandmother. He says, grandmother. Oh my goodness. Escaping his older brothers, so he's the youngest. And so he would hide because they would haze him. He was skinny. He was a soccer player. And he would cling to her knees, and she would beat his brothers off with her, you know, rolling pin thing. And then he would hide while she was making the tortellini on the butcher block thing. And then some of it would fall on the ground, and he would eat it raw. And he says that is how he began to wonder about pasta, but most specifically the tortellini. He was born and raised in Modena, Italy. It's a very small region. It's the region where he says the bones, his bones, are made of Parmigiano Reggiano cheese and balsamic vinegar rushes through his veins. That's where those two products come from. I didn't know that. In 1986, Massimo bought a restaurant. No training. Okay, I just want to be really clear. No advanced degrees. Who does that? He bought a roadside trattoria, and he had dreams, and he had hopes, but no training. And despite this, the restaurant, which served Italian traditional dishes, became a great success. It was such a success that in 1993, there was this other famous French chef, and I don't know how to say his name, but I think it's Alain Ducasse, visited this roadside place, went into the kitchen, and invited Massimo to cook at the Hotel de Paris in Monte Carlo. So just imagine, you have no formal training, just on-the-job training, and under your grandmother's table in Italy, and you go from your own roadside trattoria to a Michelin star restaurant. 3 stars. He went there. He got trained. And from there, he chose a new restaurant to come back to and create called Osteria Francescana. I'm not good at saying that. In Modena, his hometown. So here's what happened. Is there a picture? Yeah. It's in the top 5 restaurants of the world. It's just in an alleyway. Let's see the front door. That's just the plain front door. Behind this door, Massimo no longer cooked traditional recipes, but he cooked provocative Italian renditions, which were received, you think I'm going to say great, right? Not well. They were received with doubt and skepticism. It took 10 years from when he inched his way to receiving his first Michelin star to receiving his 3rd star, which is Michelin's highest restaurant rating that they give anyone, which he didn't get until 2012. Why? Because in Italy, the idea of tradition and evolution is not easy for anyone to accept. Maybe that's true anywhere. Bottura says that when he opened Francescana, the local people, few of whom would even eat there, were instantly suspicious, convinced that no one could cook better than the way they had always cooked themselves, meaning this, he says, exactly the way their mothers and their grandmothers and all the mothers before that had cooked for them. I learned through him that this is heterosexualism, but it's a man and a woman. They get married in Italy, and he won't eat his wife's Italian cooking. He goes home to his mother's tortellini. Right? It's serious. So this, of course, could be said of anywhere in Italy, a country so resistant to culinary experiments that this would happen. Grown men would go home to their own mothers. But in Modena, which was a small town, and we know what small towns are like, it was especially true. But Massimo's food blends tradition with innovation, and he manages to capture the essence, he thinks, of classic Italian dishes via modern ways. What he does is he carries the doubts of his critics, though, as he strives passionately to honor the very tradition of good food that he was raised on, while also taking what he was raised on and tradition to new places. And one of the ways he manages to achieve this is by marrying his passion for food with his love of contemporary art and his love of music. Well, it's not going to surprise you when I say that you understand that Matt and I see in Massimo's story a little bit of our church's story. We desire to learn from the old and make it new, and we think the people that come here feel the same. We long to marry our passion for the gospel with our love for music and art and the building of Christian community, right? No one quite knew this, like the author of John's gospel, who in his day was writing near the end of the first century. He addressed people who had never seen or heard Jesus in the flesh. Actually, most of the original hearers of John's gospel had been born after Jesus died, so the stories they were hearing were coming second and third hand. There were still a very few eyewitnesses around, but they would have been really, really old. So, like, think that a child who's in kindergarten on that first Easter would have been 70 when the writer of John's gospel began to write, like the story that Lori read for us this morning. So the challenge for us is similar to the challenge that John, the writer of the gospel, was facing. How do we continue to encourage people to root their lives in grace and grow in faith when Jesus is no longer around for us to know him in the flesh? I know a lot of us struggle with this. So enter Thomas. He's the man of the hour this morning besides Massimo, because by recording his doubts, the writer of the Gospel of John gave us a recipe that I think we can follow. John took the words right out of our mouths in many ways and put them into Thomas's instead, so that each of us has the opportunity to think about how we do or do not come to trust and believe. Back in the summer of 1969, Massimo and his staff were eating their ritual staff meal that they all did every day before dinner service. It's a bowl of spaghetti with beans, and I'm not going to try and pronounce the Italian way of saying it. He said, "We ate in reverence, as if a spell had been cast over us. And I looked around and I kept thinking of the tale of Jack and the Beanstalk, in which Jack upset his mother by trading a perfectly good cow for a handful of beans. Once planted, though, those beans yielded a beanstalk that reached to the sky. Could a bowl of pasta and borlotti beans hold that same prophecy? Cooking, he said, is a compression of one's life. Every single bite adds up. Could a recipe have the same resolve? Could it dignify and praise both the high and the low? Could it increase our capacity for tolerance, for tenderness, for love?" See, at this point, Francescana had been open for a little over 5 years, and it was really, really struggling to survive that five-year mark. They kept investing, you see, in silverware, really great wine bottles, fabulous kitchen equipment, and ideas. But their first Michelin star remained beyond them. And here's what Massimo wrote: "If I could just release my nostalgia and then bang at it with my electric guitar, maybe that was going to set things straight." That's what was in his mind. "I was tired of pushing against gravity with my ideas and my novel techniques. Maybe our kitchen was, I thought in that moment, hungry for a little simple humanity. A merciful bowl of beans and a generous plate of..." He was up against himself, he said. Pasta and beans, apparently, is a quintessential Italian soup. I think it must be like grilled cheese sandwich to them. It's comfort food, Italian comfort food. And he says there's nothing wrong with comfort food except that it can make you too, what? Comfortable, right? Dang. "Before you know it, you get hypnotized," he said, "into a lull. And the recipe, though, that he did there, a plain old grandmother's spaghetti and beans, was the bomb." He said, "I let down my guard and I had to celebrate the idea that the kitchen could be prosaic and unconventional, charitable and contemporary at the very same time. It could embrace my gastronomic history and leave room for my grandmother as well." So after this discovery, Osteria Francescana began to seek out, he said, poetry and the song in the recipes and the ingredients that are integral to the everyday life of the Italian kitchen. Those ordinary beans, he realized, were really what mattered. Not the stars, not the silverware, but the emotional connection in the kitchen. Technique allows us, he says, to transform our ingredients and to empower them, and to discover that the extraordinary in the ordinary is there, and we had to venture below that stainless steel into a deeper and rawer level of honesty. We began in that time to feed hungry minds as well as bellies, and I would venture maybe souls. So from that moment, it would take 5 years for Barturo to receive his first Michelin star. And when that day finally came, which is a huge day for a chef and their staff, his staff presented him with a shirt. It was made just for him. It had a single star on the front. And on the back, it read, "Where do these pasta and beans think they are going?" Where do they think they are going? Trusting in Jesus to show us the way into the heart of God, where did he think he was going on that Easter morning? It takes time, which means leaving space to figure out where he was going and how we are to follow him. We have to free ourselves from what we think we ought to be doing and allow ourselves to wander into God's mystery. Where do the pasta and beans think they are going? When Jesus said, "Peace be with you," that's it? A bowl of pasta and beans? We say, "Peace be with you," all the time. That's all you've got for us? Moving closer to the heart of God takes trying and failing and picking ourselves up and trying again and again. Tasting resurrection means recognizing the many flavors that go into creating that trust. Those flavors might be called and paired with tradition and freedom and art and music and poetry. And the ingredients, well, maybe those are practice, imagination, doubt, mistakes, and success. Mistakes and success are very, very important in the life of faith and in the life of a chef. And so we're going to show you the story of one of Massimo's most famous failures. Let's watch.
You don't realize that in your life the most important thing is to leave a free space for poetry, you don't realize the value of your life. You have to leave a free space from obligation for everything you have to do for the poetry. Sitting on a bench waiting for the bus, see in autumn the leaves, they are falling and create 1,000 layers of leaves, mille foglie di foglie, you know. But also with the poetry you can imagine something, some mistakes, and understand that mistakes is human, and in a certain way is beautiful. So one day we were at the ready to serve the dessert. So Taka, that you know, he prepared 2 lemon tart for the service. At the moment the service was ready, he dropped one of the 2 and he broke one of the 2 on the counter. And Taka was like, as a good Japanese, he was ready to kill himself. I said, "Taka, no. Taka is so beautiful, don't you see? with the, you know, the Zabayon just made, you know, was splash proper. And so I said, look, Daka, look at this. This is just perfect. So what we did, we rebuilt the same situation in another plate with all the same elements that was on the top of the lemon tart. And we rebuilt the same tart that we dropped on another plate. And we create the same situation in the two plates that were ready to serve. So we just replaced the old lemon tart from the counter and with all these different elements from south of Italy. The Zabayon replaced the Zabayon very quick and throw like that. I think that's the poetry of everyday life. You have to be ready to see things that others don't even imagine. Make visible the invisible. Make visible the invisible. And that plate became an icon.
That recipe is on the menu. It's called Oops, I Dropped the Lemon Tart. Uh-huh. Thomas was not there the first time that Jesus appeared to his disciples. Thomas was the only one of the 11 who wasn't, which tells us something, I think, about his character. Because like Peter, he distinguished himself by saying things that no one else would say. Taka, the sous chef, if you watch the movie, actually says, I wanted to commit harikiri. I mean, he was not joking. When Jesus was bent on going to Lazarus' home in Bethany, they were deep in enemy territory and everyone else was trying to talk him out of it. Thomas said, let's all of us go so we all die with him. Thomas also, when Jesus sat everyone down for the Last Supper and told his friends not to be afraid because they knew the way forward was going to be difficult, And he knew they were afraid, but he told them not to be. It was Thomas who said to Jesus, Lord, we don't know where we are going. How can we know the way and be not afraid? He's courageous, and I believe his doubts seem a lot like not really doubts, but efforts in trying to trust, right? He wasn't one to follow Jesus blindly. Thomas knew what he knew. He had studied and he had learned from the great chef, Jesus. He had proven that he knew the basics and he could be counted on to go the distance. When it was asked of him, he was courageous and brave, and he was the sort who would do the brave thing, but only after he was convinced that it was the right thing, especially after that Easter morning. That's the scene we have today. He had come a long way with his trust in God, but Jesus had died. This was a disaster, a dropped tart before service. I don't mean to minimize it. You would get fired in a restaurant for that, and it was not good. Maybe Thomas, like Taka, wanted to die too. Maybe he wished he could just go back to the way things were at the Last Supper, turn back the hands of the clock. Maybe Thomas wished he had never agreed that time to go back to Lazarus' place. Maybe he's having remorse because he took them there and that's how they found Jesus. Maybe that would have been easier. Any of those things, to imagine then tasting this new life in this new way on the other side of resurrection. But when Chef Taka dropped that lemon tart, we saw what happened. How do you do that? Stay focused. Don't look out here. Look right here. In that instant, the dessert revealed itself for the very first time. And the lemon tart has never been the same. And it's one of the most popular things on the menu. Massimo says, that lemon tart is broken again and again. And the ritual reminds all of us in the kitchen that breaking is a beginning to a new way. It is not an end. Massimo says, break, transform, and recreate. We say, taste resurrection. He said, cooking is the only way I know to bring the best of the past into the future. If traditions are put under glass, they stagnate. It's hard to stay one step ahead of nostalgia, but it is important to find that critical distance to keep moving forward, even when you are looking back. The Italian kitchen offers many opportunities to report our grandmother's recipes, but far too many of these kitchens are stuck, and they are not allowed to unleash those recipes. He calls it tradition in evolution. And it's the cornerstone of Francescana and the underlying premises of everything they do at that restaurant. And then he said this, but we did not find it. Tradition in evolution found us. As we questioned, cooked, and shared ideas, the concept grew around us like the roots of a tree. I used to think the words of tradition and evolution contradicted one another, he said. Now I see they are two sides of the same identity. Can the same be said of resurrection? Those disciples who were locked inside that room that Lori read about saw for themselves the risen Lord. They were so convinced it was him that they told Thomas to take their word for it. In a new way, Jesus was back with them. He had breathed on them and said, "Peace be with you," right? They told Thomas every single detail of those moments. And he could have said, "That's good enough for me. It's good enough for you, so I'm good to go." But Thomas didn't do that. He said, "Unless I see it for myself, it isn't real." Here's Massimo again. He said, "We've all heard it said, and we talk about this in Blueprint, that success is 10% talent and 90% practice, hard work. This phrase belongs to all of us," he said, "who believe that hard work is the only way to success. The long hours are only the beginning, though. The challenge reveals itself later as an internal struggle." And that's what was going on with Thomas, I think, when he said, "Unless I see, I will not believe." Thomas didn't find Jesus that day. Jesus came back and found him. Thank goodness, right? Thank goodness. Because that's what I want too. Is that I think a lot of us want that, to be found by Jesus. To know for certain, after all of our practice and our hard work, if only for a moment, that all of this is real somehow and that we are loved by God. It's hard, though. I've heard of things from people I really love and trust, like really love and trust, about like appearances of Mary. I've heard about that. But honestly, unless I see something like that with my own eyes, no. No. I don't care if it's on CNN. I know many are convinced of Area 51. I live with some of these people. And UFOs. But until E.T. comes and lives in my house and I hide him in my closet, no. No. And it isn't that I'm saying that those things aren't true when I'm going, no. I'm saying unless I see it for myself, they are not true for me. That's fair. I think that's fair. And I think the gospel writer of John thought it was fair too. Otherwise, why was this story included? And I think Jesus was being very generous and patient because he comes back a second time and gives Thomas the best seat in the house. And those 11 gathered get to see Jesus again too. It says, a week later, his disciples were again in the house and Thomas was with them. And although the doors were shut, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. And then he said to Thomas, put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Do not doubt, but believe. Thomas answered him, my Lord and my God. Speaking over Thomas's shoulder, I think, to the rest of all of us, Jesus says back to him, have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed, here's our message, are those who have not seen and yet come to believe. That's all of us, or at least a lot of us. Those of us who've never seen Jesus in the flesh. We have this blessing of Jesus. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe. We have the Bible, thank goodness. Really, Scripture is the recipe our ancestors created for us because they wanted us to know and experience Jesus. They wanted us to taste resurrection. And they knew we couldn't be able to do it like they did, so they wrote it down. And they gave us a choice. And we're free to believe them or not, to trust their account or not. But one thing this passage tells us is that seeing for ourselves is actually not better than hearing. We can trust both, seeing and hearing. A very few fortunate souls got to actually see and touch Jesus. But the rest of us, millions of us, get to do it this way. We can't be sure, but we must find a way into trust. Jane Kramer, who's a writer for New York Times and New Yorker magazine, she said this about Massimo, and I'm almost done, even though I have this much more I want to say. I've learned that people of Italy prefer to eat their spaghetti and meatballs at home. They get very emotional when they talk about food. Massimo Bottura is the very same. His friends know this because he thinks out loud, very loud. He starts yelling. I love him. And after studying with a mentor that changed his life, Massimo said he was changed, and what changed him was the message of freedom that he received, the freedom to feel his own fire, to look inside himself and make his thoughts edible. Now, I don't know what we all need. We don't all need to make our thoughts edible. Some of us need to make them teachable. Some of us need to make them, what? I don't know, curable, analytical. I don't know. What I know is it happens when the world we love starts coming together in our heads and in our hearts. And that's what happened to Massimo. And he says, I began then to try things for myself, to put things together and see how they taste. Massimo is just one of a very small community of exceptionally gifted and inventive chefs who have deconstructed and distilled and concentrated and, with uncommon respect, reconstructed the flavors of their own traditional cuisines. And we do not pretend to be as gifted as any of the chefs in that Netflix series. But we do believe, along with all of you, that inspiration and innovation has a very important part to play as we all today do our best to deconstruct and with respect for those faithful, generous Christians and followers of Jesus who came before us, reconstruct the flavors of what we call church. And through those flavors, maybe all of us can taste resurrection in this place, in this time, 2016, in this city, in these moments. Maybe. That's our hope and dream. And we offer this to our community as we get ready to come to this table that is set behind me. And this table makes visible for us the beauty of everyday life, the cup and the bread. That's really all Massimo is doing, right? The cup and the bread broken in creative and innovative ways so that we too might taste the love of God in our everyday life. Amen.